This is Eleanor Lacaine. Congress has finally passed another stimulus bill to help the American people in this pandemic, and after first threatening to veto it, Trump has signed it. Although Democrats fought to include aid to states and cities, Republicans oppose that, so many states and cities will soon be facing major cuts to programs and staff. But there may be another way to help fund cities and states, through public banking. Wall Street has made a lot of money for a long time by controlling the money and charging both governments and individuals for access to that money. Is it possible, at least sometimes, to cut out the middleman through public banking? Here to help us understand the possibilities of public banking for both government and individuals is our guest, Ellen Brown, founder and chair of the Public Banking Institute. Ms. Brown is a lawyer and author of 12 books, including the groundbreaking Web of Debt, and more recently, The Public Bank Solution, which traces the history and evolution of the current private banking system. She shows us how private bankers usurp the power to create money from the public and how the people can take that power back through public banks. Ellen Brown, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you, Eleanor.
I've followed your books for years and love what you're doing, and I'm excited to share what you know with our listeners because it's just so critical. Can you start us off just by simply explaining what is public banking?
Public banks are banks owned by the public. In other words, state-owned banks, government-owned banks. I mean, globally, 25% of banking assets are publicly owned, but largely, for example, in China, you think of their big infrastructure banks and their big country-owned banks. Mm-hmm. We could also have state-owned banks, and we have one model, which is the Bank of North Dakota. And in Germany, for example, they have a network of public banks, which is locally owned. So there are various models, but the point is it's owned by the public, distinguishable from credit unions, which are owned by their depositors, but it's still not the public, you know, it's not the community itself. It's just a group of people that, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Great. And we actually, as you mentioned it briefly there, we have at least one public bank in the United States now, the Bank of North Dakota. Can you talk a little bit about, how does that work to have a public bank? It's like a foreign concept. We're mostly used to Citibank and the big banks. How does the Bank of North Dakota work?
I actually think the reason nobody's heard of the bank, well, more people have heard of it now, but had heard of it. Nobody had heard of it in 2008 when I started writing about it. Mm-hmm. Because it intentionally kept a low profile. It's actually celebrated its 100th anniversary last year. It's been around a long time. And it was an offshoot of the populist movement of the 1890s. In North Dakota, the farmers were going through their own sort of depression in the, whatever you call the teen years, you know, from 1910 to 1920. And so they could see, the farmers could see that they were losing their farms unfairly to out-of-state, big out-of-state bankers who were foreclosing on their farms, and they weren't taking their grains. It was a cartel. The banks and the railroad and the granary was all one cartel. And if you couldn't get the granary to take your grain, you couldn't get it loaded on the railroad cars, and you couldn't get it out of state, and so you couldn't sell your grain, and so that's why they were going bankrupt. So they got together, formed their own bank, and formed their own granary. And so by law, and the bank now is doing fabulously well, even though North Dakota itself is not doing so well, because of course oil is one of their big products, and oil itself has done very poorly ever since 2014. But in 2014, the Wall Street Journal had an article that said that the Bank of North Dakota was actually more profitable than JP Morgan Chase and Sachs. Now, how is that possible? It's because they cut out the middlemen. So they don't have shareholders sucking out the, you know, private shareholders sucking out the profits. The only shareholder is the state itself. They don't have high paid CEOs. That at that time, I think the highest paid was, I mean, I'm sure it's still the president, but at that time he was making $275,000 a year compared to $20 million a year for, you know, I think it was Citibank or whatever. Anyway, you know, the CEOs are way up there for your big banks and other executives as well. And they, so the bank is able to make low-cost loans into the community and still turn a profit. In fact, they're not even trying to turn a profit. Their mandate is just to serve the local community. If they break even, they're doing just fine, but they have actually turned a very good profit. They don't advertise, so that's, you know, one expense. They don't have to advertise for customers, and they don't have to advertise for depositors. They're, by law, all of the state's deposits are deposited into the bank. And for customers, they actually partner with the local banks. In fact, it says right in their charter that they will not and do not compete with the local banks. And when I started writing about it in early 2009, they had the most local banks per capita. So they actually work with, and they still do, they actually work with their local banks, and the local banks endorse them. And they had the lowest unemployment rate in the country, the lowest default rate, the lowest foreclosure rate. So that's what motivated me to start writing about it. And then after a couple of years, we formed a Google group. And after a couple of years, we decided we were the experts. And that was when we had Occupy Wall Street, and, you know, everybody could see that the problem was Wall Street, but no, I've been working on that ever since.
Yeah, that's great. And you were the one who taught me about public banking. It was around that time I was cluing in, because we were searching for ways of how do we keep greater financial security for individuals and communities, because Wall Street seems to, whatever happens, always makes out like a bandit. But it, Main Street ends up being suffering. But what I found really interesting with the Bank of North Dakota, and this took a while for me to grasp, but basically we think of a bank like the bank up at the our town center, where we go deposit money and then they loan the money to someone else and charge for the loan. But the Bank of North Dakota is, has only one depositor really, and that is the state government of North Dakota. And all the money that the state gets through income taxes or whatever other revenue they get, gets deposited into the Bank of North Dakota, which gives them a big pile of money. And then when the state needs to borrow money for a project, like to build a road or a bridge or maybe a fund to fund student loans, whatever the state decides is the priority, they have that pool of money that they can borrow it. So they cut out Wall Street entirely as a middleman. Is that a good, fair explanation?
Yeah, that's basically how public banking works. And right now, the most vibrant example would be in China. I mean, that's why China is running circles around us, because they have the ability to actually, well, another thing I've written a lot about is that banks actually create our money supply, banks, not governments. In 2014, the Bank of England wrote in their quarterly report, they finally conceded the fact, I wrote The Web of Debt in 2007, but so they finally conceded, I think, because Positive Money, which is a money reform group that's quite active in the UK, I think they leaned on him so much that the Bank of England finally had to come out and say, contrary to popular belief, banks do not lend their deposits. They actually create deposits when they make loans. And in fact, said the Bank of England, 97% of the UK money supply is created in this way by banks, not by governments. And the same is roughly true in the US. It's a little less than 97%, but it's the same model. So.
Yeah, that's so great. Go ahead.
So in China, that's what they do. The bank, I mean, they own these big state-owned, Chinese-owned banks, like they have a big infrastructure bank. So the bank can just make loans for, or just create loans, write it onto their books, a loan for high-speed rail, let's say. So they created 12,000 miles of high-speed rail in 10 years. How did they do it? And why can't we do it? Because we don't have any state-owned banks like that. And then the fees from the railroad pay back the loan. So it's a circular thing, but you have to get the credit out there first to build the thing. And Roosevelt did the same basic thing, you know, get the credit out there to stimulate the economy, to build infrastructure. And then the proceeds from what you have built goes back to pay back the loan.
Right. So just to be clear, like most of us think of a bank as something we would walk up to the center or branch of the bank and put our money in. You say by charter, the Bank of North Dakota cannot do that because that would indeed be a competitor with the other banks. But this domain of the state money is where the Bank of North Dakota gets those funds and then uses it to help the community and help the state, help the people of North Dakota. It's a fantastic model. It's worked really well in North Dakota, like you've described. Through good times and bad, the Bank of North Dakota is making money, and all the profits from that money go back to the residents, you know, the taxpayers benefit by having all those funds available for whatever the state needs. So, and they've saved millions and millions of dollars in fees by, you know, not having to pay the Wall Street geniuses who connect the money with the people who need it. Just like cut them out. We've got our own money. Let's put it to work for the people of the state. It's such a fantastic model, and it's so successful in North Dakota. I'm amazed that every state doesn't have a bank. Like, we have 50 states in the United States, plus the District of Columbia. How come none of the others have a public bank like North Dakota?
Yeah, well, we're working on it, but problem is there are startup costs, which I think are more now than they probably were in North Dakota. So you have to have capital. You need a capital base. In order to create, let's say you wanted to have $1 billion bank. Let's say you wanted to create the Bank of North Dakota is actually a $7 billion bank. That's the amount they have in outstanding loans, or, you know, in assets in general. So let's say you wanted $1 billion bank, which, you know, would probably be a minimum for a state, because states are pretty big. You would need if you wanted $1 billion bank, you would need $100 million in capital. Mm-hmm. That's just for that pot of capital. You're allowed to lend it 10 to 1. In other words, you need 10% capital, and that's international. That's the Bank of International Settlements sets that limit. In March, the Federal Reserve waived the reserve requirement. So it used to be you had to also keep 10% of your liabilities, or you know, the deposits that people would want to pull out. You had to keep 10% of that available so that they could pull it out. But in March, the Fed just waived that requirement altogether. So basically, banks are just creating money on their books, and then it gets paid back, which is really where all money comes from. Virtually all money is debt. You know, it's created as a debt, and then the debt is paid off. And in fact, people get outraged because banks are creating the money, but it's really a partnership between the bank and the debtor. You know, they can't create a loan unless somebody agrees to borrow and signs on the line. So what they've really done is monetized or turned into money your own to repay. So let's say you want to buy a home. You could, let's say it's $500,000. The bank will write $500,000 into your checkbook so that you can pay your seller. But you will have signed a mortgage promising to pay that back plus interest. So what you've really done is turned your promise to pay in the future into something that you can spend right now. Or you could spend, you know, if you didn't want it to buy a house, you could spend it in the marketplace or whatever. If you're a business, you know, you spend it on equipment and then you make products and then you pay back the loan over time. So what you're doing is monetizing your future productivity. And that's really what money is. So, well, I don't want to get too speculative.
Yeah. Well, no.
Yeah.
So we have, like, say, take the state of Massachusetts, my home state, which I love, and we should have a state bank for Massachusetts. So you're saying the first hurdle is the startup cost. Say you want a bank with $1 billion loan capacity. You're saying you need to finance the 100 million, but maybe not now because the Federal Reserve waived that.
They haven't waived the capital requirement, and they can't because that's international. There is actually a vibrant movement in Massachusetts right now. So
excellent.
You know, they're actually working on a public bank, but then they're working on a public bank lots of places. But that is a hopeful one. Yeah, you need capital, and then you've got your startup costs. And then the problem is, you know, every state right now, that bill they just signed didn't make any provision for the states. And the states are suffering through no fault of their own. I mean, it really, well, you could say it's the state's governors, but all the governors have done the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Businesses have been shut down, and so they're not paying taxes like they were. So they don't have the income they used to have, and they have higher taxes or higher costs than they used to have because they've got medical costs and just all these emergency costs they didn't have, or unemployment, that kind of stuff, costs they didn't have before. So when we argue these things right now in state court or in, you know, before our legislators, that's what they tend to say. Well, we don't have money. We're broke right now. You know, we don't have money for anything. Another expense, we have a number of cities and counties and regional areas that are working on local publicly owned banks here in California. And the group that's the farthest along is the East Bay Group, which is Oakland and several surrounding cities. And they have managed to hire, it costs several hundred thousand dollars just to hire somebody to write a business plan. And it's hard.
Several hundred thousand dollars to write a business plan?
Yes.
I mean, can't we get what they did in North Dakota for free as a model?
Yeah, but the thing is, you've got to know where the money is. You need somebody who's, you know, got sort of inside information. So you'll need to find a pot of pool somewhere to capitalize the bank. So you need to know what sorts of pots of pools you have around. Anyway, they've hired, retained him. They've retained the best man in the state, recommended by the Department of Business Oversight, you know, a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just pricey. Everything's a bit pricey, and that's the problem. In Washington State, they've been working on a state-owned bank ever since 2010. Bob Hasegawa is the senator there who's been pushing it, and they keep getting more and, you know, they have more and more momentum. They have more and more senators who are behind it. But there's always, you know, it's just difficult to do something new like that. And as somebody, when I was complaining about how long it takes, somebody said, well, it took the suffragettes 30 years to get the vote for women, which you would think it'll be a little easier because it seems like a no-brainer. Yeah.
Right, or 70 years, actually. You know, if you start counting in the Seneca Falls Convention of 1848, when they first put it out there, it's like then it was only 1920 they got it. So that was a long, hard struggle, but that was like a major social political power shift for the country. This thing on
but I think this is too, in the sense that it is the big banks, it's the that do the pushback. You know, whenever we argue these things before the legislature, the big lobbyists, there are big high-paid lobbyists that argue against it. And that is either the big banks and the little banks. It's hard to even get even though the state bank will be serving the community banks, it's a little hard to list them on our side because they are afraid that they're going to have to sell out to a big bank, or, you know, they just feel that their interests are more aligned with the big bank. So they don't dare speak out against them. So it is a power play. And we know we've got, you know, a bigger divide between rich and poor now due to this virus than we had before. I mean, obviously the rich are getting richer. Wall Street's doing just fine. And people are, 100,000 businesses have been put out of business permanently, et cetera.
So here's how I look at it, big picture, which is right now we've got the cities and states struggling economically, and then for them to survive, they're going to have to tax their people more. And it's a burden on the federal government trying to do these bailouts with this and that program, whether it be food stamps and unemployment and all there is, like hundreds of billions of dollars every year going out. And that's our current reality. But here we have a solution of a state public bank that, yes, granted, there could be some significant startup costs, but once we have that public bank, that could be used to finance building roads and bridges that puts their people to work. And it's like they already have the revenue of the taxes, just instead of taking the tax revenue that the states get, instead of putting that in a Wall Street bank, put that revenue into a state public bank. There's that, and you're saying you can loan 10 times that. Say a state like Massachusetts, say they have $10 billion in revenue. If we put that $10 billion into a Massachusetts public bank, that would be, you'd have that $10 billion, you could loan out $100 billion. And then when you to do a project, say build up the roads, improve the bridges, you know, loans for students would be huge in Massachusetts, all of which would, you know, like you put the loans out for student loans, you're going to get money back from people as they pay back that loan. So you're getting the stream coming back. It's like this evergreen honeypot that never stops making money for the state, and then reduces the need on the federal government to be paying all this money in to support various programs and states and whatnot. It seems like such an obvious and wonderful solution that you would think the federal government would finance it.
Yeah, well, there is one snag there. It's not the state's revenues would be deposits in the bank. They would not be capital. So deposits are the one thing. So, you know, it used to be you needed the deposits for liquidity for when you made the loans and then the money went out, you know, you had to clear the checks and you cleared them with the deposits. But now that the Federal Reserve has eliminated the reserve requirement for deposits, and they have opened their discount window to all banks in good standing for virtually, banks can borrow for almost nothing at the Fed, 0.25%. It's actually 0 to 0.25%. So you really don't even have to worry about having the deposits for liquidity. You could go straight to the Fed and borrow at 0.25%. Mm-hmm. It's a very good deal. You know, when we've tried to do our own amateur business plans, you know, it's always, you've got to get your liquidity at 1% or something, you know, because that's what the state already has their deposits sitting in, like in California, sitting in the Treasurer's investment pool. They have $100 billion in the Treasurer's investment pool, but it used to be making 2% interest. So in order to tap any of that money, we would have had to pay 2%, which would, you know, if you want to make 2% loans, that's plus you've got your ordinary business costs. That's going to, you know, you can't do it. But if you can borrow, if you can get liquidity for almost nothing at 0.25%, you can make 2% loans, pay off your costs and still turn a profit, you know, turn some, return some money to the state.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly right. So there we have it. The federal government through the Treasury provides the funds at nearly 0% interest. You could, why don't they use that money to set up state banks?
Yeah, they should and they could. It seems to me. But again, you're getting, Chase Bank is using, going to the discount window. It used to be banks didn't go to the discount window because there was a penalty attached. You know, it's an extra 0.5% in interest or so, and or 0.75% in interest, and there were, it was a stigma attached. Like if you went to the Fed, it meant that you couldn't borrow anywhere else for cheaper. You know, you had to pay this higher rate. But now the Fed has dropped the rates way low, and they have said, "Come one, come all." You know, open it, in good standing. So Chase is borrowing there. They've got the more deposits than any bank in the country. They've got a huge percentage of all of our deposits. Mm-hmm. They're borrowing from the Fed. Why is that? Because it's a really good deal. So we should be able to capitalize on that too. But then we get all this pushback. You know, we get pushback from the big banks. We get pushback from the legislators who are afraid to put their money into the state bank for fear it'll be, you know, they think you're handing it over to politicians, which you absolutely are not. You're handing it over to seasoned bankers, but then that's another thing. You've got to be able to pay for seasoned bankers. And they have a strong public banking group in Germany. The Sparkasse Banks, and I was told by, when I did a presentation along with someone else in Iceland from Sparkasse Bank, he said, we don't hire seasoned bankers. He said, we hire them fresh out of college and we do our own way, you know, so they don't expect to be making $20 million a year as a CEO, but I don't know that we would follow that, but that's one reason that they managed to be so profitable or so successful.
Right. So I think we have the major problem is the startup costs, you know, the business plan and the initial capitalization to be called a bank. Mm-hmm. And once you've got that, you've got a steady revenue stream from the one depositor would be the state revenue. And we've solved the startup money problem by knowing the Fed has unlimited money that it's giving right now at the 0.25% interest. So say the state of Massachusetts could go to the Federal Reserve, get whatever money they need to start the state bank with the 0.25% interest, and then make a loan. Like you said, why not make college loans? They're ridiculously high. You could do student college loans at 3%, and you're still making money on that coming back in, and you're off to the races. So it seems like, go ahead.
One problem is in California, and I assume other states are the same, we're not allowed to borrow the money for capital. It has to be money you already have. So you have to go find it somewhere in some fund held by the state or by the city already. So we couldn't borrow it from the Fed. And the what you borrow from the Fed is liquidity. So that's the money to clear the checks, or it's, you know, what would have been deposits, but then the Fed has said, don't worry too much if you run through your deposits. In fact, they said, don't worry if you run through your capital, because they're trying to get the banks to make loans into the real economy, but the banks aren't doing it. And that is the reason, or one major reason, that we have this great divide between the rich and the poor. The banks don't want to lend to these small businesses that might go bankrupt. They do want to lend to the big corporations that are, you know, making money hand over fist, Amazon and all those things that are squeezing out the small businesses. So we still have this, the divide, you know, rich, poor divide getting bigger and bigger.
So if I were the governor of Massachusetts, I could say I want a public bank and we've got the revenue here. Say it's, I think it's now $20 billion a year revenue the state gets. We're going to deposit all that in the Bank of Massachusetts, and then we get whatever money we need for liquidity at 0.25% from the Federal Reserve, problem solved, we're off to the races, right?
Well, the 20 billion, no, you still need, if you're, depends, if you're, the 20 billion would be the amount you would lend, or that would go on the ass, or sorry, the liability side of your bank, meaning you owe that back to the depositors. And so you could balance that with an equivalent sum in loans, but you still need the capital. So you're still going to need 2 billion in capital from somewhere. And that, at least in California, you can't borrow that even from the Fed. But there is this public banking bill that's currently before Congress that was brought by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Rashida Tlaib. I don't know that it has a great chance of passing, but in the bill, they are asking for some money to be designated by Congress to actually help capitalize public banks or some local public banks, certain ones. I think maybe the ones in particularly in deprived communities.
So there we have it. So that gets back to my argument. If the federal government would put that money that the states need to capitalize public banks to get them going in the even the midterm, that's going to save the federal government a lot of money, because that then enables the states to be making loans and making money off of the loans that they get from their revenue, like the Bank of North Dakota does.
Mm-hmm. There's another very good bill, H.R. 6422, which is an infrastructure, National Infrastructure Bank bill. And that's a bill to form a bank on the same model as the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, which is what Roosevelt used to mm-hmm. build the country in the 1930s. I think that bill has great, great potential, because it will make $4 billion, I believe, in loans. That's what they're, to do infrastructure. And we actually need even more than $4 trillion in infrastructure now. We're so mm-hmm. far down in everybody agrees we need the infrastructure. Nobody, where they can't agree is where to find the money to do it. And the proposals before have been these public-private partnerships, where basically the private partners
makes the money.
So this would be one that's on the same model, where you just generate the money, get it out there, build the thing, and the proceeds from the thing, like an energy company of some, some sort of maybe solar or whatever, and things that pay, like trains, high-speed rail, mm-hmm. Those are self-funding loans. That's how the Reconstruction Finance Corporation did it. Then you're still going to have, there is infrastructure that doesn't pay back, like, bad roads. If you fix the roads, you don't charge anybody for it, so there's no income from that. But there are different studies that show that if you put money into infrastructure like that, you actually increase the GDP substantially more.
Right. Money. You're creating jobs, so people then pay taxes, so you have more revenue flow.
Yeah. Not to even mention increasing quality of life, which everybody is in favor of, clean air, clean water, roads that get you to work on time, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So now, have you written a white paper? We know we've got a new president coming in on January 20th with a very bright vice president from California, first woman elected vice president. Have you done a white paper that says, here's what the new administration could do to help cities and states address this revenue shortage problem?
No, but there's these three bills right now. There's the public banking bill, which does address that. And then there's the postal banking bill brought by Bernie Sanders and Kirsten Gillibrand. And the National Infrastructure Bank bill. So I think those all do cover it, but that's a good idea. I think I might just wait. We'll see. Janet Yellen will be, if she becomes Treasury Secretary, that will, put, and I'm waiting to see all those pieces fall together. But yeah.
So I think that would be great if you, maybe you and I should co-write an article on what the new administration could do around you know, like using this moment to advance public banking. So anyway, we'll talk about that later off air, but I'm here in DC. You've got the expertise in public banking. Let's team up.
Okay, that's great.
And I want to shift now to talk about individual banking. We've been talking a lot about the public banking in the sense of the state or municipality, city could have its own bank. I want to talk about individuals and versions of public banking. And of course, you mentioned the post office. What a lot of people don't realize is the U.S. Post Office did offer a lot of basic financial services for decades. And you could go to your local post office and make a deposit. You got your deposit book stamped and, you know, some basic financial services. That was then cut off. I think, I'm not sure when it was, but it was cut off. There's still a few little services they do, not little, you know, people can send money overseas through a postal service, but it's such an important thing. So many people now are cut out of basic banking because they're too remote or then don't make enough money. And but there's a public post office in every zip code all across the country. Everybody can access their post office, and we could return those financial services from the postal service to make it available to everyone at affordable rates. What do you think of that?
No, I think it's a great idea. And I did write about that in Web of Debt and, you know, multiple times after that.
Right.
So we had a postal banking from 1912 to 1967, I think. It was very successful, particularly in the Great Depression, when the private banks were all bankrupt. And that was, you know, that's what the Banking Act and all that, you know, what Roosevelt stepped in to try to fix when he did a banking holiday and so forth. So people were afraid to have their money in their private banks, and they pulled it out and were putting it in the postal banks. And for that reason, of course, the Bankers Association was totally opposed. I mean, they were opposed to this system all the way. So they lobbied to get restrictions put on the postal banks so they couldn't, they could only do very modest services. They couldn't expand. Like you say, it's a perfect setup. They've got all the infrastructure. They've already got buildings everywhere, so they could just open. That's what they did. They had one window where you would mail your packages and another window where you would go deposit your checks, right in the same building, and they could easily do that now. But instead, what Roosevelt's government should have done, it seems to me, was strengthen this postal banking system. I mean, it was really a national public banking system. And but instead, they put all these strictures around it, so it couldn't do very much. And they supported the private banks, particularly with FDIC insurance. So we, the people, said, don't worry, don't pull your money out of the private banks because the government will insure the deposits. Well, that was a huge, huge benefit to the private banks so we are on the hook for, we're guaranteeing that the private banks don't go bankrupt. And instead of that, I think what they should have done was just allow the public banks or the postal banks to do much bigger things, make big loans instead of just the little overdrafts that you could write on your account. Mm-hmm. But there is a bill to I think it was filed in September by Bernie Sanders and Kirsten Gillibrand to go back to that system. So you would have a place for anybody could open an account there. It would be a good place to put these checks that everybody's getting, which aren't as big as people had hoped. But anyway, you know, it'd be an easy way to get them directly to the people. You just go to your post office And they could make certain limited loans under the bill. They're not allowed to. The problem is that the Postal Banking Act itself, or the post office itself, is limited in what they can do. But one thing they can do is make these very small loans in the form of, I think originally they were just like overdrafts where you would just write a check for more than you actually had in the account, which would be a loan, you know, at interest. Anyway, not only would this be a service to all those unbanked and underbanked, which is something like 25% of the population, but it would generate some revenues for the post office, which is floundering. And it's floundering because in 2005, I think it was, there was a bill that forced the post office to pay, to have enough money to cover the medical costs of its employees for something like 75 years into the future. I mean, no other business is required to do that. And so that's why they're struggling, and not because they don't make money, you know, just, I mean, they could cover their costs with stamps like they've always done, but for the fact that they have these extraordinary expenses that have been imposed on them by Congress that haven't been imposed on other agencies or other businesses.
Right, exactly. So we're in agreement, expanding the postal service financial opportunities would be a great way to help a lot of people with simple, low-cost financial services. So that's a great thing to do, and it's been done before. You can bring it back and do it even bigger and better now, and save the post office while you're at it, which we all want to do.
And it wasn't even original to us. I mean, countries all around the world have postal banking. When I first wrote about it, Japan had the largest depository bank in the world was their postal bank, but now they've sold off some of it after the, you know, some disasters that they had to pay for. But go into all kinds of conspiracy theories about that. But anyways, no longer. But anyway, it's a great model, and it's worked in many, many countries. And it's just a
fun thing. And it's worked in the United States.
My daughter lives in Switzerland, you know, and people go to the postal bank, or I mean, the postal bank and the private banks are all the same. Nobody pays any attention to which.
So we definitely want to bring back and expand U.S. postal banking through the U.S. Postal Service. I wanted to ask you about something I heard about, and I'm not sure how feasible this is, but this again is about individual banking services. Right now, pretty much as I understand it, any company can go to the Federal Reserve and open up a line of credit, as you say, with low interest rates. Could the Federal Reserve, if it wanted to, open that up to individuals as well as private businesses, so that you and I could go to the Fed and withdraw money at low rates and pay it back?
I don't think businesses can't go to the Fed. I mean, you might be thinking of these special purpose vehicles that were set up between the Fed and the Treasury, but that hasn't been used all that much. That's why they're shutting down many of them. There is talk of a central bank digital currency. In other words, a central bank would basically be issuing dollars straight into your account, or, you know, there's talk of central bank accounts that everyone could have, and central bank, they'd be working digitally. So they're not printing actual paper dollars, but just issuing digital dollars. And China already has that. And for that reason, China is liable to be, you know, I've seen talk that they could be the next reserve currency. They could be squeezing the dollar out because they have the One Belt, One Road program all around the world, where their infrastructure in different countries. So those countries would probably be happy to take their digital yuan through a digital network. Some people say it's blockchain, but it's not really blockchain. It's really a centralized digitized system, but 97% or 95% or, you know, a major, well over 90% of our money is already digital. Mm-hmm. It's just in banks and in your bank account, and it's created on the books of banks as loans. That's where it comes from. It's not created by the Fed or by the Treasury. Now, I personally would prefer to see Treasury digital currencies or a Treasury account rather than, you know, the central banking network is a global thing that goes through the Bank for International Settlements, which is shady at best. And do you trust this big network or cabal or whatever you want to call it? Private central banks are largely private or privately controlled or privately manipulated. Whereas the Treasury, of course, it still depends on who's in charge of the Treasury, but the Treasury at least is technically owned and operated and working for the benefit of Congress and the people. We did set up the Federal Reserve, and so the Federal Reserve Act can be changed, but that is a major, you know, that would be a major struggle in Congress.
Right. So tell us about your organization, the Public Banking Institute. What do you do there?
Well, we started in January of 2011, and we've just worked to get state-owned banks and city-owned banks, you know, locally owned public banks set up across the country. We've got, I think there's over 25 active bills right now, and we're particularly active in California, New York, New Jersey, hopefully Massachusetts. That's kind of a new one, but they're working hard. Several other places, anyway. Colorado, Washington State, still pushing in Washington State. So we, you know, as we discussed, we come up against these various barriers. In California, we had a bill last year to turn, well, we had a bill earlier to turn the, we already have an infrastructure bank. It's called an infrastructure bank, but it's really just a loan fund, a revolving loan fund. It's not a depository bank. So there was a bill to turn it into a depository bank so that it could borrow directly from the Fed very cheaply and create 10 times as much in the way of loans as they have in capital. At that time, they had $300 million in their loan funds. So they would lend it out at 3%, it would come back, they'd make 3% a year on it. But if you took that $300 million, called it capital, you could then lend $300 million. I said this right. You could lend $3 billion. Anyway, you could lend 10 times as much and make 3%. So you basically are making 30% less your costs, whatever your costs are. But still, it's a much more lucrative way to do it, and you can make a lot more loans. And there's a huge demand, like 20 times as much demand for these loans as they have the ability to make loans. So that bill was brought several years ago and didn't pass. And then it was brought again last year and it was withdrawn, but they plan to bring it again next year. Anyway, that's the type of thing that, you know, we try to promote. We have a newsletter and we have meetings once a month, two meetings a month, Zoom meetings, one that anybody can join just for informational purposes. And lately, we've gotten like 30 or 40 people on those Zoom calls, and one that's just the coordinators, the people that are working on setting up public banks in different areas. We've done quite a few in this last year, virtual town halls where we get legislators and public banking people together doing presentations on what's going on and what the possibilities are and so forth.
That's great. So for our listeners who want to learn more about it, what's your website that they can go to learn more?
Publicbankinginstitute.org.
Publicbankinginstitute.org. Great. So get connected, listeners, and find out. It's like honeypots of money out there, we can cut out the middleman of Wall Street and have our cities and states thriving financially, jobs for people who need them, roads rebuilt, student loans out at 3% interest. And, you know, it's creating the America we want by getting control of our money. So it's going to take a little work, but thank God we have Ellen Brown here on our side with all your wonderful knowledge about that. And before we sign off, I just, you know, I did note that you have written like 10 books on alternative healthcare. So health is obviously a huge issue now in the era of the pandemic. And I just want to know, and I know it's a while back and you're more current with the public banking, but I'm curious, since you have so much expertise and background in it, and I don't think it's changed too much, but what do you see happening in terms of alternative healthcare treatments, maybe the acupuncture or things like that? Are they being actively suppressed, or it seems to me it's a way to help a lot of people with, in many cases, positive impact with less intervention and very little negative side effect, if any? Like, why isn't alternative healthcare more included in the mainstream of our healthcare system?
Well, of course, those options are still available, but insurance is a big part of it. I think we should have Medicare for all, but we could make it much more efficient if we incorporated natural remedies or ways of taking care of your own health so that you know you're not so likely to need these really expensive treatments. But the whole alternative healthcare was cornered 100 years ago. There was the Rockefeller Flexner report that where they went into the different universities, and if they weren't using patent medicines, which are drugs, which, you know, the pharmaceutical cartel is, and the banks were closely connected. That's how I jumped from writing about the drugs are oil based, they're petroleum based. So you've got Rockefeller's father was actually literally a snake oil salesman, literally sold snake oil. And, you know, they went from there to patent medicines with the oil-based medicines. And then the American Medical Association Journal only took, they gave their seal of approval to patent medicines or, you know, pharmaceutical drugs. And they published, they were funded through advertisements of these pharmaceutical drugs. And so they wouldn't publish studies about anything natural. You know, anything natural that worked, never, those studies did not make it into the medical journals. They were actively suppressed. And it's very like we have the same thing going on with television right now, where their big commercials are drug commercials. So they can't really talk about things that are anti-drug or, you know, that are natural, various natural remedies or, you know, anyway, that it's a captured medium, just as the American Medical or the AMA journal was captured originally. And before that, the homeopaths were actually a much stronger medical therapy in the 19th century than patent medicines, that patent medicine people were the bloodletters, that and the homeopaths were just squeezed out by this sort of very like what you have going on today, you know, just cornering the market, regulating, capturing the regulators so that anybody who practiced anything that was outside the standard of care might lose their license, and that's the way it is right now. I wrote a book called Forbidden Medicine about a cancer healer in Tijuana who I thought was brilliant, was doing a great job. I interviewed lots of his patients and so forth, and I actually worked on his lawsuit. Mm.
Well, that's fascinating. I want to have you come back sometime and talk about alternative medicine, because I think that's a huge issue for a lot of people, is getting control of our health, whether it be the pandemic or even before the pandemic. The majority of Americans are very sick with major chronic disease like diabetes or heart disease or cancer. It's like over half the people have a major health issue. So I definitely want to circle back if you're willing to come back. But thank you. That's all the time we have today. And
okay. And thank you, Eleanor. It's great to get your door.
Yes, exactly. So that's it. That's Ellen Brown, the founder and chair of the Public Banking Institute, and also another radio host on PRN Radio. So check out her show every 2 weeks. She's got a show going on. Thank you so much for being here, Ellen. Look forward to being in touch soon.
Okay. Thank you, Eleanor. We should interview you as well.
Anytime.
Okay.